Today's Bible reading is from the book of Exodus, chapter 16, verses 1 through 15, found on page 66. The whole congregation of the Israelites set out from Elim, and Israel came to the wilderness of Sin, which is between Elim and Sinai, on the 15th day of the second month after they had departed from the land of Egypt. The whole congregation of the Israelites complained against Moses and Aaron in the wilderness. The Israelites said to them, "If only we had died by the hand of the Lord in the land of Egypt, when we sat by the flesh pots and ate our fill of bread, for you have brought us out into this wilderness to kill this whole assembly with hunger." Then the Lord said to Moses, "I am going to rain bread from heaven for you, and each day the people shall go out and gather enough for that day. In that way I will test them, whether they follow my instruction or not. On the sixth day, when they prepare what they bring in, it will be twice as much as they gather on other days." So Moses and Aaron said to all the Israelites, "In the evening you shall know that it was the Lord who brought you out of the land of Egypt, and in the morning you shall see the glory of the Lord, because he has heard your complaining against the Lord. For what are we that you complain against us?" And Moses said, "When the Lord gives you meat to eat in the evening and your fill of bread in the morning, because the Lord has heard the complaining that you utter against him, what are we? Your complaining is not against us, but against the Lord." Then Moses said to Aaron, "Say to the whole congregation of the Israelites, 'Draw near to the Lord, for he has heard your complaining.'" And as Aaron spoke, the whole congregation of the Israelites, they looked toward the wilderness, and the glory of the Lord appeared in the cloud. The Lord spoke to Moses and said, "I have heard the complaining of the Israelites. Say to them, 'At twilight you shall eat meat, and in the morning you shall have your fill of bread. Then you shall know that I am the Lord your God.' In the evening, quails came up and covered the camp. And in the morning, there was a layer of dew around the camp. When the layer of dew lifted, there on the surface of the wilderness was a fine flaky substance, as fine as frost on the ground. When the Israelites saw it, they said to one another, 'What is it?' For they did not know what it was. Moses said to them, 'It is the bread that the Lord has given you to eat.'"
I confess that I am absolutely sick and tired of working on the parsonage. Not quite. Randy, if you're free tomorrow, we might have a little bit more work to do over there to finish it up. So you're busy. I am so tired. I am only the second happiest person that is almost finished. I think the happiest is probably Sherry. And I got to say, this thing would not have happened without Sherry. She was really the spark plug that put it all together. And I don't know what it is about her, but all the contractors that she worked with, they all just really enjoyed working with her. And she was fun to work with. She's just got a great spirit about her and determination. And so she is the one who made that place transform to a dive, which we were all ashamed of, especially on the church council. We continually struggle with, oh my God, we don't want to be slumlords, and what do we do? And so it was actually good news when the renters informed us that they were moving out, and so that gave us a chance to get in there. And in 3 weeks' time, we totally transformed that place. It is really amazing. I hope you go over there. Once you get a cup of coffee and a cookie or something, go over there. The parsonage is across the parking lot. I lived there for 14 years. A parsonage is just the name of a home that the church owns that the pastor lives in. So I lived over there for 14 years until I got married to Anne, and I moved up in the world. So moved to a nicer place. But I am really, really tired this morning. So you're going to have to bear with me, yeah. Yeah. Actually, my mood is a little bit fitting with the text this morning that Sharon Berler read to you. I think she could have gone on in that same text because it goes on and on and on about manna. And it gets a little tedious after a while. And sometimes these Bible stories can be so efficient in the telling of their tale, and then other times they just go on and on and on. It's kind of like the description of the tabernacle, the building of the tabernacle, wherever that is in the Bible. That just goes on and on for chapters. But this part of the story is actually very non-dramatic, and it's in quite contrast to what we talked about last Sunday, which was a highly dramatic story of the people of Israel who are fleeing the Pharaoh and his army, and of course that great story of passing through the water on dry land with Moses holding up his staff, Charlton Heston holding up his staff, and then of course the whole Egyptian army being destroyed, and it was all very dramatic. But that's where that story ended. But the next story begins when the people witness this, and then they turn around and they look at their future, and it is a wasteland. There is nothing out there, and so going from slavery, where they still had enough to eat and they had a place to sleep, to head off into the wilderness with nothing but the clothes on their backs and the gold and the silver in their pouches and the unleavened bread that they took with them. These are people who are not used to surviving on their own. A natural analogy occurred to me this morning when I was just kind of thumbing through the most recent issue of Popular Science. It's a magazine I subscribe to. And in it, it talked about the 10 different ways that automobiles are going to be radically changed in the coming years as they are being reimagined and re-engineered. And at one of the auto shows that are coming up, they are going to build a car with a 3D printer there at the conference and drive it off stage. I thought, wow, you know, that's not going to work. Murphy's Law, I don't think Murphy's Law gets factored into things like that. I hope it works. But can you imagine printing, Bill? Something from 3D like that? I'm not sure I'd feel safe in a car that was built by 3D. But then they have to take it out on the test track. And, you know, all these big auto companies have test tracks. And when they develop a new car or one is a prototype or, you know, they're thinking about this or that or tinkering with some design, they have a test track, and on the test track, they take the actual car out there and they run it through all different kinds of conditions, weather conditions and road conditions, and they measure and they count they just see how well the car does under these road conditions. Because once they start building millions of them and they are released out into the highways, they are responsible for whatever might go wrong in the design or the engineering of it. So these auto companies are very, very careful, very precise about getting everything as right as they can with the cars that they are going to sell and the cars that we are going to buy and live in and depend on. I know this is a reach, but this experience of going out into the desert, into the wilderness, is like a test run for these people. And they are going to be run through their paces, and they're going to fail, and they are going to be redesigned, and they are going to come to terms with some of the design features that they have to live with, and the conditions under which they have to operate. And one of the things people don't really know about this story, about 40 years being out in the wilderness, is these people were not lost. People have that impression that they're lost in the wilderness, you know, finally they finally find their way to the promised land after 40 years. That's not the case. They get to the promised land rather quickly, and they send in scouts. And they say, oh, you know, the people who are living there, they are a well-organized people. They have armies, and there is no way we can come in and take away the land from them. And so back out into the wilderness they go. And so they spend 40 years in the wilderness becoming tough, being redesigned. And the people who first arrived at the promised land and didn't go in never make it, because 40 years later they're not around. So it's the next generation, actually, that makes it to the promised land. And so the whole idea of being in the wilderness for 40 years, and this is what the text says, that it was designed as a test. So this giving of the manna and the quail is a test. And it even says so in, oh, I think verse 3 in the text that I didn't bring my glasses, so I can't quite see it. But the whole thing, I think, is arranged as a proving ground. That's another good metaphor to use. It is a proving ground where I'm not so sure I would do very well, because I have all my needs taken care of. All I have to do is go down to Vaughn's or Ralph's. I go to Ralph's sometimes, Brian, wherever you are. And food is not a problem for me or for most people here in this sanctuary. Food is not a problem. But food becomes a crisis here in this story. And it becomes a crisis because these people are left on their own. They have no resources. They have absolutely no resources. And Dave Teese was out in the wilderness these past few days, last week for 3 days, alone by himself. But you brought food along, right? And so food was not a worry. If you got lost out there, food might become a crisis. Because when we go hiking or camping, you know, we kind of bring all our comforts with us as far as that goes. But we know that we can go back home, and food is not a problem. And that was one of the options for these people. At least that's what they thought. They thought that, you know, Moses, you brought us out here to the wilderness to die. You know, why didn't you just leave us in Egypt? At least we had food to eat there. So the temptation was always to go back. To go back into slavery, and to go back into the world in which they knew, even though they did not thrive, but they knew it very well. And so what they're going to learn in the whole book of Exodus is how to depend upon God. That's ultimately what the test is, how to trust God. And that's a very difficult thing. It's really easy for us to be in this nice air-conditioned room and in nice clothing and having been fed this morning, talking about how easy it is to trust God. It's really hard for us to get into touch with how difficult it is to trust God when we have nothing that we can lean back on. When something terrible happens in our lives and we can't manage it, we don't have any control over it or power over it, we get panicky and we want to go back to what is familiar. And Michael, in talking with the children, told you what the meaning of the word manna is. And it's a question, you know, what is this? It's a little bit like God's name, Yahweh, means I am what I am, or I will be what I will be. It's a verb. And so manna is a question. What is this? And this story is as non-miraculous as the story was miraculous last week. The parting of the water and all that kind of stuff, you know, was something that was completely out of our hands. But this manna and the quail, all of these things came from the natural world. And as the way Michael described it, is probably what happened. That this manna was what they found to eat out in the wilderness. And of course, they thought that that was from God. And when you're in the middle of nowhere and you have no resources and you come upon fresh water or something to eat, what's the first thing you do? Oh, thank God. Thank God. And I think that's probably their attitude. And it seems so trivial. I mean, when you describe manna, as Michael did, it seems like the simplest of food forms. And we were kind of joking a little bit about eating that for 40 years. It's kind of like eating oatmeal for 40 years. I mean, wow, can you imagine eating the same thing for 40 years? And of course, there's this phenomenon of quail happening to, you know, to come into the camp. And, you know, there are all kind of scientific explanations for all these things that happen, which are kind of beside the point. But the point being is that all these things are from God anyway. And we take them for granted. And I think people relied on manna for 40 years, and they learned how to rely on God. And it was very difficult to begin with. They had not only a food crisis, but they had a water crisis. They had not only a water crisis, but they had the crisis of having to survive on their own. They had the crisis of faith that they had to actually put their trust entirely in God. So this is what the proving ground is, and it's difficult for us to imagine this because we're not in a proving ground. We are in a world in which we have constructed with our own hands. And that gives us the illusion that we can guarantee our own safety and our own future, that all we have to do is project into the future what we've done already. And that is, we know how to grow food, we know how to feed a lot of people, we know how to get from point A to point B, we know how to live well, we know what it means to thrive economically, all that kind of stuff. But when you take all of that away, then it's a different game. In fact, it's not even a game. It's a whole different planet, I think, that the conditions are so drastically different than what we're used to that it's really hard for us to even imagine ourselves into that situation. And one of the reasons I like this story that we're looking at this morning is because it is all very, very natural. It is this worldly. And it is very the common blessings of God. And that is something that is really hard for us to see. We tend to think that we thank God when something exceptional happens. You know, like, you know, you get a check in the mail for $5,000 that you weren't expecting. You know, you thank God, you know. Or you get a job, you know, that you've been wanting to get for a long time. You know, thank God. But what we miss by thanking God for these exceptional things is the fact that God sustains us with ordinary blessings every moment of every day of our lives. And we tend to overlook that. We tend to take that for granted, which is natural. I mean, you can't go around thanking God for every moment. You know, thank you, God. Thank you, God. Oh, thank you, God. I mean, no, you just can't do it. You can't live that way. But it's easy to forget and get out of touch with the fact that God provides us with the ordinary things in this ordinary world that are quite amazing. The appearance of manna was a godsend, quite literally. But each breath that we take is a godsend. And I think Bill and I would probably attest to that, right? Being short of breath. And my mom was short of breath in her later years, and breathing became a crisis. And when you can't breathe well, you realize that breathing well had been a gift all along. And when it's taken away from you, you realize how precious that gift was. It's like when you begin to have heart problems, you realize that all those healthy years that you had with a healthy heart, wow. And just go down the list of all the ordinary things that we have in this life that that we just take for granted, thinking that it's just life and it's natural, but these are all the ordinary blessings that God continually gives us moment after moment after moment. And I think getting into touch with that is very, very important, because if we don't get in touch with that, we are laboring under the illusion that no matter what difficulties we might face in the future, that we can handle them on our own. And that's not the case. There are some situations that come upon us that we have no way in which to cope with, beyond our abilities to manage. And so I think that being in touch with the ordinary blessings of God is very, very important. Now, built into this story, and it elaborates on it, Sharon was able to read farther into the text, it elaborates on how carefully managed Yahweh's expectations were with respect to this manna. It wasn't just free-for-all. There were certain conditions. You could only gather it for the day, and you couldn't save it overnight because it would go bad. And it seemed like no matter how much they gathered, if you thought you had too much, you had enough. And if you thought you had too little, you had enough. And so there was this weird equation, this weird mathematics going on about food, where there was always enough for everyone. And people still, with all these stipulations, tried to hoard the manna. And that's what the story gets involved with later on. You can see them out there, you know, thinking, you know, well, if I can get one jar for today, well, maybe I can get two, and maybe I can sell it. You know, and really that's where the problem begins at that point, the idea of hoarding these natural blessings of God. Now, our society has gotten ourselves into a situation that we take as normal and natural that is highly distorted and does not really address the common good very well at all. One of the things that people of Israel learn in the 40 years that they're out there, not only do they have to trust in God for their future, but the health of the community is more important than the health of the individual. That's something that we're finding out in our study of 1 Corinthians, in our Bible study, is the community. The health and the welfare of the community is more important than the individual. And now, our society, we've got that backwards. You know, the individual is more important than the community. Now, there are good things and bad things about, you know, either way of living. But our society is based on strict individualism and does not really address this problem of the common welfare, the common good. One of the helpful things about this story of the people of Israel is that it is put in such simple terms that we can see how the dynamics work. At such a simple, rudimentary level, we can observe and see how the whole thing works. Our world is so complicated and has been going on for so long that we really don't understand how it all works. And I think the problem that we run into is that we have lost track of the ordinary blessings and where those ordinary blessings come from, and the problem of hoarding. The problem is that the hoarding that we do can dissolve in the same way that the manna does. And of course, in 2008, September, we saw much of our manna that we have been saving for our future just kind of melted away. And now we're in a situation where the stock market is up again and everybody's feeling good, and there will come a time when it will go down and the wealth will kind of melt away. And even on an individual level, it doesn't matter how much money you save up to a point. You know, they find people and money, they're happy when they make more than $50,000, but if they make $100,000, they're no happier than $50,000. There's a certain level that you make where you're happy, and above that you don't get happier the more you get. But if you fall below that, you're unhappy because you can't afford the things, the basic rudimentary things of life. So point being is that we can save all the money that we can save, and we need to do that for our future. I'm not arguing against, you know, saving for the future. What I'm arguing against is the conventional wisdom that we can guarantee our future by doing that. Because all the things that we count on in this life are going to melt away. including our physical body, through death. And so we see all of this, how these dynamics work with the people of Israel in the wilderness. And then I think by looking from their perspective back into our own lives, we can see how things are working a little bit simpler with our own lives. And the common good is so important in the Bible throughout, from the book of Genesis all the way through the book of Revelation. The common good is always the issue. And the problem is always people, a few, hoarding things at the expense of other people. That's always the problem. It has been since the beginning of culture. I don't want to say the beginning of time, because the beginning of time was billions of years ago, and our society has been around only for about 10,000 years. And so the problem hoarding is a real problem, and that's what makes everything unbalanced. And the way that we can rationalize that in our own minds is by saying that the individual is more important than the community. That's how we are able to rationalize that. So I can make as much money as I can at other people's expense, because, after all, the community is not nearly as important as me as an individual. So we are in a world that is so different from the world in which we're looking at in this story that it is odd to compare one with the other. Now, this story in Exodus is so clear about what God wants and what is valuable and what is not valuable and what is harmful. These things are so clear in this story that if we start to apply those same dynamics to our own life, we realize that there is a clarity that we can gain from this story about our own lives that can kind of point to what the problems are. And the problems are, one of the main problems is this tremendous and growing gap between the extremely rich on the one hand and, you know, everybody else on the other hand. And, you know, we can go through the statistics, which I don't really want to do because that's beside the point. But that's always been the problem, is the concentration of wealth. And that was the problem back in Egypt, was that the Egyptian empire was based on the accumulation of wheat and food. And they controlled the food that they were hoarding for the future. So, well, I'm not going to go on and on about this because the story goes on and on about it. But to be clear, the point in this story is that ultimately our well-being is in community with one another, and our well-being depends upon the ordinary blessings of God. And the community goes out of alignment with itself when a few of the individuals start hoarding things at the expense of others. And so the Christian community is meant to be an experiment. Even though it was started 2,000 years ago, we're still experimenting. And so what we are as a community is we are supposed to be an alternative to the way the world works. Here, we see in the Bible that the community is more important than the individual. It's not that the individual is not important. The individual is very important. But the health and the welfare of an individual depends on the health and the welfare of the community. So just one example, those people who deny climate change, for example, think that somehow because they're rich they're going to be exempt from it or they can avoid it. Every individual is dependent upon the health and the welfare of the community of life in this world. And so I think these are the takeaways from this story, is that God is very specific in what is good for us and what is not good for us. And so that's who we are trying to become, is to become an alternative example in the proven ground of what a community looks like that values the health and the well-being of the community. And that's our goal. In fact, that was our motto during our 100th anniversary, is becoming what we believe. And I think that that works in the story, and I think that works here. And so ultimately, I think at some point in our lives, we're going to realize that not everything is under our control, and that at some point, we have to entrust our lives into God's hands, because that's where hope ultimately is. Not in our hands, necessarily, but in the hands of God. And may God bless us as we become that community in which we believe.
Will you join me in prayer? What a wild journey it is when we follow where you lead, God of adventure. And shouldn't it be so? You offer us wild journeys into self and other, love made real inside and out, explorations into the universe becoming aware of itself, ourself, you and us and it, the holy cosmic truth of spirit and bone and time, bound together in adventurous interconnection. You, like water, flow through every nook and cranny of our fear and hesitation, seeking out our driest failings and watering them until they flower with mercy and anticipation. You call us into the wilderness just as Jesus and Moses and our ancestors of Israel were called into wild and contemplative adventure. And when we choose to pitch our tents where there is no food, we grumble about hunger. How easy and cynical and ugly we grumble. We grumble to our leaders, and our leaders grumble. Grumbling, hungry people, forgetting that no matter where we are, you are there too. And so food is there, so abundant it falls from the sky. God of abundance, you fill our lives with choices and our minds and hearts with the creativity to dream and to plan. Even when our dusty grumbling looks like fear and hesitation, self-doubt or envy, we will feast on the bread of life, the promise that the web of creation is stronger than that which opposes it, and that life in the wilderness offers wonders. God of the common and ordinary, in whom we place our trust, may we be your manna in the world, your daily portion, as you feed us day to day. Amen.